Okay, so I've been asked to talk a little bit about weak lensing, so I'll basically go very briefly to some of the results we obtained with the red sequence survey done in Toronto with Howard G and Mike Letters. So that gives you a flavor of things where we are right now with weak lensing. I'll briefly touch upon the future, which for us is the CUHT legacy survey. So I hope you remember what weak lensing is. There was a good introduction yesterday, but there are just a few things I want to remind you of. Is essentially what weak lensing is what you see here. Here you have strong lensing. When you can see it, it's strong lensing. If you don't see anything, we call it weak lensing. And basically, another thing is that generally lenses produce tangential alignments of the images of background galaxies. And if you look, so this is the blow up here, well, with your eye, this looks like a random distribution of galaxies. But if you measure the shapes of these galaxies, and that's essentially what weak lensing is about, you measure shapes, and then you combine the ellipticities of all these galaxies, you'll find that the major axis of your ensemble average object is the major axis directed in this direction, which, if you plot it here, is a nice tangential alignment. So that's a good signature. So essentially what we do is we measure shapes. Unfortunately, galaxies are not round, and we have some intrinsic ellipticity, and we measure a slight change in the ellipticities of these galaxies, and this is what we observe. So this is very small, and particularly for the things I will be discussing, it's extremely small, and typically all observational distortions are much larger than the signal we're after, so we need to correct for PSF anisotropy, camera distortions, etc. So we use the Kaiser-Squires-Broaddus technique, which for the data so far, we have it tested extensively, and it works really well. It might be that for future surveys, we need to improve a bit on that, but I would say so far, there's no indication that we cannot correct for observational systematics. And another thing to remind is, and which is very important, is that lensing measures, so gravitational lensing essentially produces an E-mode, a curl-free pattern. So this is your typically tangential alignment. If you have an overdensity, this should be a void. And we shouldn't be able to see this, although there are some mechanisms at a very low level could produce this, or also intrinsic alignments of galaxies could produce this. But in principle, if we have pure lensing, the signal should be curl-free, and that's a very important test. We measure a spin-2 field, and we are after only one quantity. We have a redundancy there. So just a quick overview of the red sequence cluster survey, which is now complete. It's an 85 square degree survey in two red filters, although for the northern part, we have also BNV imaging data, which we did with CFHT. The southern part is done with CDIO 4-meter telescope. So it's a pretty large cluster survey. And this is our projected cluster sample. So depends on redshift. So the aim was really to find a sample of high redshift clusters for which we have currently about 10 clusters. We should have about 300 intermediate redshift. We basically increased the samples by a factor of 10 or more. But of course, this is not enough. So we propose to do a survey which is 10 times larger to do equation of state.
I'm sorry, you have 10 right now and you have 300 shortly?
No, 10 is what you can find in the literature. We should have about 300. But we have 300. Our survey, yeah.
Okay.
But we want 10 times more. So we are making a preliminary cluster catalog. And one thing, although I won't mention in the talk, so one thing we plan to do is use, because that's the thing with these cluster surveys, you have tens of thousands of clusters. And if you want to do cosmology, you need to know their mass, their redshift. That's very expensive if you want to do it the classical ways. So the trick we want to use is to use richness, basically how many galaxies are there, and calibrate it using lensing. And we can do that with the survey data. We already have, just from the survey data alone, we get about 7% accuracy in the mass calibration. We project for our full sample in combination with additional data, say legacy survey, should be able to get the mass calibration down to 1% accurate, although we're still looking into what are potential systematics, but at least the calibration, assuming that richness and mass correlate, what they do, we can get down to 1%, which is very useful. We do follow-up observations, and basically they show that the clusters we find are genuine clusters. If you look in near infrared for the high redshift clusters, we find strong lensing, X-ray is kind of interesting. We find a few clusters which are extremely rich in the optical, but are kind of underluminescent in X-rays, which might be a problem for X-ray surveys, although we need to investigate a bit more. And we do a redshift survey also to look for that.
How are you tracking the calibration of the weak lensing? I mean, the weak lensing mass?
So for the survey data itself, it's just techniques. You use an ensemble average for different bins in richness. So basically, you get a number. So you bin in richness, and you just measure what is the lensing signal for those clusters. And you find a nice linear relation. Well, we find a relation. So the question is, what is it scattered from cluster to cluster? We don't know yet, but we do additional investigations to get that, to address that. You do deep imaging of a number of clusters.
Don't you find it a bit surprising, though, that the richness calibrates so well with mass? And
no, it's exactly.
Richness and
it, no. No, because richness is exactly what does measure the same thing as lensing does. It's a projected quantity. And if you look at mass light ratios of clusters, they show remarkable little scatter. So if you do careful analysis of a number of clusters, it's very little scatter in their mass light ratio.
You're saying that there's a big scatter between, or a significant scatter between the X-ray luminosity of these clusters and their richness?
No, well, there's a thing, right? All clusters people have studied so far are X-ray selective. Most clusters at intermediate redshifts. And so there's a bias in the literature towards very relaxed systems. Once you go to high redshift, that's a tricky assumption.
The question is, the luminosity is depends on the outcomes in the very central regions, which is known to scatter a lot. Temperature, X-ray temperature has a small, smaller scatter, which is a good indicator of mass.
Yeah, but we want a cheap one. So you want to go cheap. Well, you cannot get temperature for 10,000 clusters. So that's the whole trick. And there's a reason why this should actually correlate very well. So we do a lot of lensing with RCS, although it wasn't intended for that. So for instance, some strong lensing. It's not quite a topic here, but we have a very nice cluster. We have got a redshift of the high redshift arc. We have another system, although it's exactly in a regime where it's hard to get redshifts. So this is a nice pretty image. So this is an optically selected cluster at redshift 0.8. It's an extremely massive system, and this one is also X-ray luminous, but there's no doubt there's mass there, I'd say. So let's go to the weak lensing results. So we have done I've done the full CVC data set and a little bit of CDAO data. CDAO data have poor seeing, so it's actually only 9 degrees, which is really useful. RCS is relatively shallow. We go down to R of 24, but it's still lots of galaxies. So first go to the cosmic shear signal, which is measuring the clustering properties of dark matter or matter in the universe. So the aim there is cosmological parameter estimation. So what we use, we measure the ellipticity correlation functions and we transform them into a useful statistic for display purposes, because this map statistic has very nice properties. I won't go too much detail. So what you see here is the E mode or the curl free component of the signal, and this is the B mode, which is what you get if you rotate objects with 45 degrees. And I've made different cuts in our source galaxies. And if you take the full cut, you see that there is some, on large scales, there's no B mode, essentially, but on small scales, there's some B mode. So we investigated this a little bit, making a cut in bright galaxies. Bright galaxies are large. We should have no trouble correcting the shape because there's hardly anything to correct anyway. So, and there's a suggestion that, well, in these scales, there's a significant signal. We see a significant B mode for these galaxies, which should have no problems. But if you take bright galaxies, they span a relatively narrow range in redshift, so you expect to get increased intrinsic alignments. And Slam will talk, I guess, that could introduce B mode. So we decided to use our faintest sample, and particularly on small scales, there's a negligible B mode, so systematics are well under control. On these scales, we don't really know what to do, so basically increase the error bars. But mainly, when we do parameter estimation, it is dominated by these points. So that basically gives us a parameter estimation on very large scales.
So would you say, if you go back to even the G mode, if you look at the big galaxies or the bright galaxies, it goes up at small separations?
Yeah, well, this is not very significant. right?
Would you say that that might be also different interesting
line? Well, this could also be noise. I don't know. So that's hard to tell. Well, so the thing is that it's tentative here, but it's not, well, look, it's not very high signal for noise, right? Once we get our B and V imaging, we can do this much better. We can basically correlate galaxies with similar photometric redshifts. So you start projecting out the intrinsic alignment signal and see really what are the observation telling us. So you can do different things. You can choose all kinds of priors, just assume nothing about the universe, say it's flat, or you can say it's an open model, and you get different. So we find right now joint constraints on sigma 8 and omega matter, because we're measuring two-point functions, essentially measuring clustering. So once we apply all kinds of other priors, a very simplistic approach, so part of the aim of the meeting here is to do a more elegant combination with CMB. But this is our best estimate. So if you use omega 0.3, you get something like 0.86 with pretty small error bars. But it's marginalized with these kind of priors.
How big is this array?
So what we used is 52 square degrees.
So you just used boomerang, not all of the CMB data?
No. So this is because if you use all CMB data, you get a contour which is perpendicular to this line. But the problem is you have also the optical depth tau, which comes into there. So we played with that and get constraints on tau, although we're not, it was more to play with it. Because people have been claiming that weak lensing sigma 8s are too high compared to CMB values, although Dick would say, well, he finds 0.85. And also, if you play with tau, because all these models are done with tau of 0, if you increase tau, you get higher sigma 8s from CMB. Whoops. This is a hopefully the outdated plot, because since the summer have been several publications. But in general, as Ludo von Warbeck would say, this plot is from him. You should, well, green is for a reason, because these are two measurements use full marginalization, include cosmic variance, whereas some of the other surveys, they fix a lot of parameters, which basically decreases your error bars, because basically you hide your ignorance. And overall, the weak lensing values for sigma 8 agree very well with one another, although, well, cluster surveys now tend to find somewhat lower values, although, so there's still some discussion what is the value of sigma 8. That's a good question, because people get confused by that. That's called marginalization. When you do marginalization, so the one I showed before was with these priors. This was with marginalization with very weak priors. So basically, your maximum likelihood peak changes position, which confuses a lot of people.
Can you tell us what the priors
are? So here is the priors are listed. So it's a prior on gamma mainly, and the source redshift distribution, very narrow prior. Whereas this one uses much so. This uses a prior on gamma, which is rather broad, and also the source redshift distribution is much broader here. So basically, I say I don't know anything. I know a little bit, but not so much. Yes, what are you?
The two results use peak of dots.
Yeah. So that's another.
What happens if you use Smith at all?
Well, Smith, yeah. So if I use Smith at all, this goes down by about 8%. But it's not clear whether the Smith at all. So what they did, their input power spectrum is not what we use. So basically, you get confusion there. You use a Bond and Astathew power spectrum. Whereas for this, we use BBKS. And ideally, you want to use a CMB fast power spectrum. So there's some discussion what is. So there could be like a 10% systematic error because we don't know really what the nonlinear power spectrum is. So there's some confusion. But I think this should be pretty close. There's like, if you use different things, it's about 10% right now.
What did you guys use?
So when Lam says you guys, he's referring to a survey of Mike Jarvis, and others, which is about as large as your survey. From that data, we were able to use results only between 10 and 100 arc minutes, which are essentially insensitive to the nonlinear correction.
No, they're still, there's still, because my signal is on scales comparable to yours, and there's still an effect. There's still, you're always...
It's more like a 1% effect in their data, because I've checked it. Not a 10% effect.
Well, it,
so they get 0.7.
Yeah, but they have a different... They have a shallower server, yet a higher mean redshift, so that's a bit confusing what is going on there.
Well, so that,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Whoops. So another thing is the galaxy mass correlation function, which you can use for many, many things. So let me just show results now. So this is the galaxy mass correlation function. Basically, you measure the shear around galaxies, and that can give you important information. This is a zoom in, so just for reference, an isothermal sphere plotted in. So what we can do, we can study properties of galaxy halos, which has always been a problem with other things, because you need a visible tracer. And you can do different things. You can study the biasing relations, or what something I've been doing last week is you can deconvolve this correlation function and use a parameterized model. And, well, right now we just use the R-band magnitude, so I have a factor of 4 uncertainty in my luminosities. We should get a factor of 2 improvement when we use colors. But still, we can constrain scaling relations between the size, if you use the MFW profile, the typical scale in the MFW profile, and the central density. And with these parameterizations, you get M200 roughly scales as this combination. But we get fairly decent constraints. This basically gives you the Tully-Fisher relation. So that if you combine this into a rotation velocity, we get the Tully-Fisher relation out. And this I was very pleased to do. So we have a model, an MFW model with a density as a free parameter and a size as a free parameter. And you just do your maximum likelihood analysis. And these are the likelihood contours you get out. Well, if you believe CDM, then NFW makes a very definite prediction for a given delta, what its RS, what its size should be. And that's this line. So the weak lensing, and I would say this is the cleanest test of NFW profiles to date. All the other tests basically involve regions, looking at regions where baryons, well, are present, and people have argued in LSBs baryons shouldn't do much. Nevertheless, there are baryons, and this is a very clean test, and we find NFW is a very good prescription, at least for galaxies around 10 to the 10 solar masses.
Wait, so is that testing in the actual NFW profile, or?
No, this is an NFW profile, and this is the NFW prediction, how these two quantities should correlate.
If you had, like a Moore profile, would that curve actually change?
If you have?
A Moore, minus 1.5 slope.
Yeah, so I haven't looked at it too much, but what I've done so far, if you use a steeper profile, it tends to increase your RS. So I don't know what the more prediction is exactly whether it would change RS, so I have to look into that a bit more. But at least.
Can I ask a question also? So is it the case that you fix the profile shape exactly, and then use data which is mostly at scales larger than on this x-axis to say that if the profile is exactly NFW, what RS has to be?
Yeah, so if you change the central profile, that might change a little bit. So I have to explore that part.
So it's a consistency check on NFW. It's not a proof that NFW is correct.
No, because I plug in an NFW. But, well, it's not bad, right? There are people on this planet that say this shouldn't happen. Right? So.
I would think, follow up with that question, I would think because your data really tells you the mass, the mass that galaxy correlation on scale actually larger than these.
Yeah, but still, this is just brute force, large number of galaxies. So there is a difference when you have different profiles.
But the smallest separations that you can actually look at are not actually this kind of scale.
Yeah.
They're larger.
No. This is 10 arc seconds. This is 10 arc seconds, which is, have plenty of galaxies there. So we really probe that part of the density profile quite well.
Well, it's a very small separation, the Schrödinger noise should be large.
Yeah, but we have also a lot of galaxies. It's really, this is purely square root of n working in your favor. So you just have brute force, large number of galaxies, and you in the end get constraints. Well, they're not Well, there are nice constraints. It's not, well, you still have a pretty large range, which is allowed, but.
You're also not trunking.
I mean, NFW is contained.
Mm-hmm.
So, you still have
some. Yeah. Yeah, it's basically you have a combination, you measure something very large, you measure a mass and something else, and it contains the information. Other prediction is that halo should be flattened. We did a very simplistic thing. Say that your halo is F times the observed ellipticity of the galaxy. Well, we get very good agreement with CDM predictions. We get a B over A of about 0.65. And we exclude spherical halos with 99% confidence, which is a very nice thing. So this is the first direct measurement of flattening of halos. You can do also biasing. So 2DF has done some biasing work in Sloan. So I don't have to show this, but basically this is the idea of what is biasing is. Can we look where people live on Earth looking at the light? Well, so these were two images of Earth, same size. So it's clear where the people live in the US. But of course, we know that's not the case because half of the people live actually here. So the US produces half of the light, but not half of the people. So that's essentially what galaxy biasing measures, because we want to use galaxies because they're easy to see. So can we get cosmological parameters from that? And actually, there are two parameters then. There's a this is your classical bias parameter. It's basically the ratio of the two variances. But of course, that's not enough because you can have two random fields which have some dispersion. And that basically, this is the ratio of those dispersions. But you need also to go look at the cross-correlation coefficient to see if they match. And so this is our measurement of bias as a function of scale. So this is a direct measure of biasing as a function of scale, which is usually not accessible to many other techniques. And this is in the nonlinear regime. It's very small scales where a lot of things happening in galaxy formation. And we also, so this is a combination with RCS data and Vermos data. And so this cross-correlation coefficient is essentially only accessible to weak lensing. And we have been exploring this a bit more. And this one is very interesting because observationally, this is a very robust variable. We can measure this with very high precision. With a legacy survey, we think we can measure 1% accuracy on all scales. So briefly, the legacy survey, we want to go to deeper fields, but also to larger angular scales. So this would be the future of the coming 5 years. There's three components. I'm interested in these two, and I'll talk about this one. It's a wide, deep, weak lensing survey, about 180 square degrees, eye limiting magnitude of 24.5. We use five colors, U, G, R, I, Z, so the Sloan filters. And some of the major goals are measure the power spectrum from L to 100 to 10,000 with very high precision. Hopefully, we can do the 3D mass power spectrum. We want to measure the bias parameters out to 20 to 30 megaparsecs. So we go from 150 kiloparsecs out to 20 megaparsecs with a function of scale, few percent accuracy. So we'll really constrain models of galaxy formation because the scale dependence really can tell you something about how galaxies form. And use results to constrain cosmological parameters and equation of state. So I'll stop there. Any more questions?
So you're saying introducing CMB data without knowing anything about randomization worsens the constraints, right? Like you were in the sigma 8 omega matter.
No, we don't care about, we don't have any constraints on randomization. But the CMB.
Tau, I'm sorry.
No, but if you combine with CMB,
right.
You have to include tau because
right.
The CMB has sigma 8
tau.
Right. Yeah. And people so far, so in the Lahav paper, it's there. But not in the abstract. In the abstract, they list tau of zero.
Right.
So, and people kind of seem to have forgotten that.
Okay. But if you introduce just the known band on the primordial spectral index, that doesn't better the constraints for you?
Well, so this was a very simplistic approach. You should do a full likelihood, combined likelihood analysis, which is what we're supposed to do here, I think.
Okay. Can you define your B and R?
Yeah, so, well, B is your, no, I have to
put, it's just the ratio of the 2.5.
Yeah.
And R
is the cross-correlation divided by the square root of the two autocorrelation. So it's your classical, what you get in high school, how you do a linear regression.
And you try to make sure all of these quantities are all measured at the same fractions.
Yeah, so that's actually why the combination with Wormers was very nice, because we measure them, actually the windows in redshift match very well.
So let's go back to sigma 8, the topic of the day. So you're saying Jarvis et al. Is 0.71 error.
I'm sorry?
So what, I want to understand the level of discrepancy here.
Right.
If there is one, or if it's statistically not a
discrepancy. 15. So as they say it, they agree with all Lenzing results except the von Warbeke result, and von Warbeke agrees with all Lenzing results except the Jarvis. So basically, those are the two extremes. So that's very.
It's a bit
0.11 or so.
Yeah, it's a bit of 0.1.
Yeah.
It's a signal change.
Yeah, so basically you're discussing here two extremes. Like one is on the high side, the other one is very low.
No, but what I heard from you, which actually speaks a little bit against the discussion we had with Ludo yesterday, is that the statement is that the Jarvis survey is probing well the linear regime, and that there is almost no nonlinear correction.
That's correct. And they're sort of forced to do that because on scales of 10 minutes and smaller, the B mode is significant. So in their natural weighting, which tries to use the region where the B mode is the least, they weight half a degree scales very heavily.
So when they got the sigma 8 result, what did they marginalize over?
They didn't marginalize over anything.
Right, so they assumed basically a fixed cosmology and then that sigma 8.
So they get a constraint, they get sigma 8 omega matter to some power, right? And they know the redshift distribution, and their dependence on gamma goes like gamma to 0.1, I think. It's very weak because they're probing scales of 10 megaparsecs.
Yeah. Although you have to be a bit careful with knowing the redshift distribution, because I've made that claim as well. And theirs is somewhat weird, I would say. So it might be a filter thing, because there are subtle differences, but they have a higher mean redshift than we do, and we are deeper. So there are subtle things. Yeah.
No, but there are subtle. So what we know is that clusters are all over the map. Weak lensing looked like it was going on the slight high side. Now we've got some different results. But as far as I mean, let's just take a step back here. If somebody's saying 0.9 and somebody's saying 0.7 with 10% errors, this is not an issue at this stage. It may emerge as an issue, but it isn't an issue now. I know people love to make issues out of non-issues, but in this case, I wouldn't have said that we have a problem with that.
No, the consensus is that there's good agreement. No, there is.
There's a serious two sigma issue.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, so who's next?
I mean, let's figure out, do we have time to do two talks, or? I could go.
Why don't you go if we don't have time?
We have about 20-25 minutes before we
should
have
these.
So, spend
20
minutes.
I could also force people to come
somewhere. Me too.
There's almost 3 minutes.
20.
Can someone help me with this?
Two.
Don't you want it closer to get it smaller? I don't know. Okay, most of what I'm going to talk about is work done with Masahiro Takada, who's a postdoc at Penn. I would like to talk about two things. One is a new way of doing lensing that I believe will be very valuable with a space-based imaging survey like SNAP, whether it can be done usefully with things like the CFSD legacy survey or the LSST survey remains to be seen. This is just sort of the trivial idea that, you know, you can think of lensing as distorting shapes or increasing the sizes of galaxies, and you can decompose the effect in this way, although of course in a real lensing situation both things happen. Any guesses on what has set the scale for these two circles? If you examine the top and bottom of your coffee cup. So this is what, you know, this is the way lensing has been done and it seems to work. I'd like to suggest that the simpler effect of lensing, which for very good reasons has so far not been useful, can in fact be quite valuable. So the idea is that lensing increases sizes, the area is scaled up by the magnification is given in terms of the convergence and shear, like this, and in the weak lensing regime, you get this. So that means that magnification produces a linear shift in the log of the size of a galaxy. Right, if you take, if, for example, if you want to use radius, you take the square root, do the Taylor thing, you get r times 1 plus kappa. And so log r goes to log r plus kappa. So that means that if you could detect fluctuations in the log of the radius, you would get a direct measure of kappa, which is the convergence. So there's a short and very simple-minded paper that I've written on this, which suggests that by using a statistic like this, you can measure the variance and the fluctuations in sizes. The idea is that if you have a patch on the sky of size theta, you measure the mean size of galaxies in that patch. You compare that mean size to the mean size of all galaxies, and you average over all such patches, and this is an estimate. The problem is that sizes are affected at first order by a point spread function. So if you are measuring from the ground, you have variations in scene. Well, they're tricky because even to measure shapes, you have to correct for them. But they are much more tricky for sizes because it's first order effect. It should still be doable if you really understand your PSF. You know, just like you do for shapes, you calibrate your PSF with stars in the field. You do your polynomial fit, and you correct for it. So that's I think, an interesting challenge for forthcoming weak lensing surveys from the ground. But from a snap-type imaging survey, it should almost certainly be doable. If you have 0.1 arc second pixels and that kind of a resolution, then you really should be able to resolve your galaxy sizes, measure surface brightnesses, get estimates of sizes that use the surface brightness, and is therefore unbiased with respect to lensing, and get an estimate of kappa, of kappa squared.
You must have an intrinsic
size dispersion, right, which is somewhat larger than the intrinsic ellipticity dispersion.
Right.
So that was one reason. That and the PSF issue are the two reasons that sizes haven't been used so far. With the forthcoming 100 square degrees type surveys, this is one of the points of this paper, if you do a signal-to-noise estimate,
versus angle theta. Then the solid line is sort of this fiducial survey geometry that I've used, 100 square degrees, 40 galaxies per square arc minute, you know. So I'm saying that for 40 galaxies per square arc minute, we can usefully measure sizes. So it's not a very ambitious claim. And these two curves show the effect of varying depth or varying number density. So if your number density were half as much, you'd have this curve. So the point is that on all of the small scales, your signal, your noise is dominated by sample variance or presumably some level of systematics will kick in. And so you have the luxury of throwing out a lot of galaxies.
Why don't you get sample variance on these clustering of the sources themselves with each other? I mean, what you do at the end of the day is you count how many galaxies you have at a certain size, but that fluctuates because the sources themselves cluster, whereas in the shapes, the shape correlations would give a similar effect, which has been estimated and known to be small, but the clustering itself, clustering of numbers is much, much stronger than the clustering of orientations.
You mean clustering in redshift?
Yes.
Right. So the idea is you'd use photosees to bin source galaxies.
You only use correlations between galaxies at different redshifts.
Well, you can use fairly broad bins, right? Yeah, so that's right.
Is size correlated with luminosity?
It could be.
If it is, you would have to worry about magnification of size.
That's correct. So the only way magnification has been measured so far is through magnification bias, which is sort of a slightly indirect effect on number densities. So yes, subject to various caveats, I still believe that with a snap-time imaging survey with photosees and this kind of resolution, the signal-to-noise is, you know, going to be within a factor of two of shapes.
Maybe try to look, say, at ACS images and see what your noise is. Because I tried it a long time ago. It's very noisy from sizes.
I tried with the medium deep survey and didn't get a detection, but the size histograms and stuff seem all reasonably well behaved. But with the ACS data that, I'm planning to do that with Jason Rhodes and others. That should be interesting. So, well, what is the advantage of doing this other than having another complementary way of doing weak lensing? Two, one is that you measure kappa directly. So that's nice because, you know, it's a scalar field. You can measure skewness and so on straightforwardly rather than having to do a global reconstruction. A great advantage, I think, will be in galaxy-galaxy lensing, where right now the kinds of results that Hank showed and that have been obtained from the SESS, they use the tangential shear around foreground galaxies, which measures the averaged mass inside an aperture. Whereas if you had an estimate of the convergence around foreground galaxies, you would have the projected mass inside annular. And so you would be able to measure shapes of profiles, rather than have to parameterize them. I could stop right here if it needs time, or I could talk 10 minutes about something really complicated. So, feel free to just raise your hand and I'll stop. Okay, but
about 10 minutes.
Okay. So I'd like to talk about three-point functions of shear. Or polarization fields. The question is that if you are given a field, a shear field, just to give you a visual image to go with this, you're given a field like this, and you want to measure a three-point function. Okay? So you want to place triangles all over this field and take products of the shear at the three vertices of your triangle. The first thing to note is that if you use Cartesian components of the shear and fixed origin, any three-point function must vanish. And so you can't do that. What you can do is you can fix a center that you can choose the origin of your coordinates at the center of a triangle. And with respect to that center, you can get non-zero odd moments. And then you place several triangles all over your field. Each time you locate yourself at the center of the triangle and measure three point functions. At each vertex, you'll have two components of the shear. So that means this 2 × 2 × 2, 8 3-point functions. These 8 3-point functions can potentially be measured out of existing data, like Hank's data. Ludovic van Verbeke, Francis Bernardo, and Jan Collier have been measured one such 3-point function out of their data. So it's worth asking, well, how many functions are there? What are they good for? And so on. So I just want to point out one thing here, that what are the components of the shear? As Hank pointed out, you can construct tangential and radial projections of the shear, but these are just the plus and minus versions of one component because the shear is a spectral field. And the green lines are the plus and minus versions of the other component, which are called the cross component. And one property that these components have is shown here. So if you have a triangle and you measure the tangential radial component, which we call the plus component, then that component under reflection is invariant. You reflect this triangle, you get back the same thing. However, if you measure the other component, it changes sign under reflection. Okay? So these functions have parity properties. And in the last months, there have been 3 papers that have looked at all these 8 functions. What are their transformation properties? What are they good for? And I'll show you the results that Masahiro Takada and I obtained, in which we posed the question and then addressed it by just measuring it out of simulations and also doing Hilbert calculations. So this is an isosceles triangle, and we define parity even and odd modes depending on whether there are odd or even numbers of this cross component. So these functions all have even numbers of the cross component that is 0 or 2. And there had been some issue as to whether the parity odd modes must vanish or not. And we found results that agreed with what Schneider and Lombardi worked out, which is that these modes don't have to vanish. In this case, out of the 4 functions, 2 vanish. And you can see that if you spend a few minutes staring at this, but we won't, and 2 don't. So the point of this is that we have 8 functions, and I'll just put up.
Excuse me. So why the part of the old one, this green and this yellow one, this seems to be exactly negative to each other.
That's right. For an isosceles triangle, this one is the negative of this one, and these 2 are both 0.
Yeah.
That's because
so they are not independent. They are just.
That's right. They're not independent. Exactly. And you can see why if you just did it. For a generic triangle, this time the side lengths are all unequal. Oh, by the way, did I explain what I'm plotting? This is the 3-point function versus the interior angle of a triangle with the side lengths fixed like this, 1 and 2 are currents. So for this generic triangle, all I want to point out is there's 8 functions that all have complicated behaviors and that all have kind of comparable amplitude. Right? The shear at each vertex is about 1%. So the amplitude of these is a 4 × 10⁻⁶. And now I'd like to claim that it's really useful to measure these functions out of your data for 2 reasons. One, you can test the data very exquisitely in terms of this E and B mode stuff. We because these even and odd properties shown here work if you have a pure E field. If you had a pure B field, they would be flipped. So if you measure these eight functions for varying shapes of triangles, you would get a rather exquisite probe of the level of systematics. Because systematics is believed to populate B and E modes equally, and so to the extent that these symmetry properties were violated, you know, for example, you could construct a combination of this function plus this, and that would be zero, and to the extent it's not zero, you have a B mode. The other reason is that these functions are a really nice probe of Hiller profiles. And I will unfortunately not have time to explain why, so I will just put up a concluding transparency. So I showed you three-point functions of shear fields, right? We've done calculations of three-point functions of the mass, the shear, galaxy three-point functions, as well as some measures of the four-point function. Because we believe that with current and forthcoming surveys, you can certainly measure two-point functions very, very well. But you will also measure three-point functions pretty darn well, well enough that you can measure several of them against and plot them against the three variables that define a triangle, and learn things. In the quasi-linear regime of this scales, both out of lensing and out of galaxy surveys, you can measure additional cosmological or large-scale biasing sort of parameters by combining two, three, and four-point information. On small scales, going down as far down as you think you want to trust gravity as being the dominant force, they tell us about the halos of big galaxies, groups, and clusters. And in these papers, we have shown us a way of calculating these functions using the Halo model. And we believe we actually have a pretty accurate model for making these predictions, and also for showing how these functions depend on properties of Halos. So there is an alternative approach to measuring Halo profiles, which I think would be valuable from NICE data, which is that rather than, say, identify halos in a lensing field, find their centers, assign them masses, and stack them up to measure their profiles, you don't do that. You just measure three and four-point functions across your whole field, and you parameterize your halo properties with a few free parameters, and you fit for them from the data. So they're two radically different approaches, one in which you do things to the data, but then get a profile out, and the other, you treat the data rather objectively, but you put in theoretical biases of how to parameterize your profile properties.
Because if you didn't ask what the answer was, how many independent correlation functions there really were out of the gate?
There are eight three-point functions that you can construct out of a shear. The shear, if it's derived from a scalar field, must have only one underlying three-point function. And this is easy to see in Fourier space. You can write down the bispectrum of the shear in terms of the bispectrum of the convergence. From real space measurements, as far as I can tell, it would be a non-local operation to combine the eight functions into a single one. And so, to the extent that you have noisy data over a finite range of scales, I think at this point, as far as I know, one just must measure the eight functions.
Well, no, you say there's some symmetry, so there are only six. You reduce it to six already because two of them.
No, not for a general
equilateral. Only five. So an observer had better record all eight.
Yes. And probably the first measurements will actually be most useful for learning about systematics.
I measured the full 3 points, the full all eight of them out of the Wilmot data.
Uh-huh.
And I did the E and B projection out of them.
Okay.
I did the E cubed and the B cubed out of it.
All right.
And the B is about a factor of five smaller than the E on the data.
That sounds good.
But the things I couldn't quantify, which is hoping to hear from you is how do you quantify correlations and error bars and short laws in a three-point function? So you have a three-point function that's a huge dimensional space. You have think of noises which is tiny in each region of the three-point function. And then when you bin it up, you have correlated, the errors do correlate. And then you've got to quantify how correlated errors are between bins of three-point functions. And that's something I could not come up with a good way of quantifying in Monte Carlo way, because that you get different, get a one factor of two different answers from Monte Carlo way, is what I would have gotten by just propagating errors, assuming they were independent.
Yeah, I don't have an easy short answer to that question. We can talk about it.
Generally, if you're willing to use the Hadamard models, and one Hadamard term dominates, then probably it's not hard to calculate the covariance.
That's right. So we can calculate them, certainly. Yeah.
Thank you. So then, can you do 5 minutes?
Do we have time?
It's 1 o'clock now.
Right.
People are waiting to start.
Yeah.
You want to?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll be less good.
All right. So what I want to do is to explain something that we all grew up with the idea that if you go to large scale, fluctuations become simpler, becomes linear, and Gaussian. What I want to argue is that there is at least a case in which actually that's not true, that when you go to large scales, the non-Gaussian contribution actually dominates. And this example occurs in the case of what have been mentioned is intrinsic alignment. And it's the idea that galaxies might be intrinsically correlated in their orientation. And the argument is actually pretty simple. So let me think of some more. So the argument goes as follows. So I'm trying to do it in as few steps as possible. So if this is actually work that has been done by, for example, Wei Li, a lot of the ideas is from Wei Li and his collaborators, which is that you look at the angular momentum of galaxies, and if you assume that the angular momentum basically comes from tidal torque as the galaxies undergo collapse, then in the simplest version of that theory, the angular momentum would goes like the gradient of the gravitational potential. All right? And how is the angular momentum related to the observed shape that you measure? Well, the simplest model you can make is, think about spiral galaxies. You have a circular disk. The angular momentum, the way it points respect to you, your line of sight, would determine the shape of the galaxy, right? And if you work out the ellipticity of the galaxies, then it turns out you can work it out. It goes like L squared. The simplest way to see that is just if you break out the ellipticity into two components, then one component go like Lx squared minus Ly squared, where x and y are axes in the plane of the sky, and z is along the line of sight. And the other component goes like this. The important point is that the observed ellipticity goes like angular momentum squared. Okay? And this basically tells you it goes like the gradient of potential squared. So at any given point, or at any given galaxy, the observed ellipticity goes like basically the gradient of the local gravitational potential square. Okay, so now when you ask, how are galaxies at two different parts of the sky, how are they correlated? What you are basically measuring is the two-point function of the ellipticity at point one and point two. And if you believe this theory, they have to be correlated at some level because there's large-scale tidal correlations in the gravitational field. And
so the correlations and the absolute ellipticity, not the way they're lined up. Do I understand correctly?
It's in the way they line up. So they're correlated.
This looks like a scalar L squared.
Yeah, I'm being very crude here. So what is what
you mean like the square root squared or something?
Yes. What you really should do is actually this. It actually these are the two components of the elliptic, and it goes like basically these components. And in fact, here is actually more complicated than that. You have to contract this with basically the moment of inertia tensor.
So actually, the galaxies will be pointing the same way.
That's right. At some level, the angular momentum, the direction of the angular momentum of these galaxies should be correlated at some level.
Because they torque each other finally.
Because there's some correlation in the tidal field that actually talks up the galaxies. All right. So if you work this out, and I'm going to even drop the gradient here. So I'm going to be very simple-minded about this. So the efficiency at 0.1 goes like basically 5 at 0.1 square, because this is square. The efficiency at 0.2 goes like 5 at 0.2, also square. So you have to calculate something like this if you want to calculate the correlation. The usual way it's done is to say, well, let's assume on large scale things are Gaussian, the gravitational field is Gaussian, and so if you work out this, there are actually three terms. One of the terms looks like this, which is basically this contracting with that and this contracting with that. So you have a term like that. And then you have actually two more terms. But the other two terms actually vanish because basically the other two terms goes like the average of the elliptic. And the average elliptic has to be zero. Okay? So that's only this term left. And the point is that if you assume Gaussian fluctuation, this is just basically the two-point function that we are used to square. Okay? So this is a usual argument. This is the argument that is in the literature. And if you assume Gaussian fluctuation, it looks like the two-point function of the elliptic goes like the mass correlation square. And that is the origin of some of the statement that sometimes people make, that on large scales, the elliptic correlation should be small, because the Lensing correlation goes like psi, goes like this to the linear power. And this drops with scale. So on large scale, this should be relatively unimportant. So what I want to point out is that if you actually include the non-Gaussian terms, the fact that these fields actually are non-Gaussian, that's actually a term that goes like this to the linear power. And this is well done with a student at Columbia University, Jun Zhang. And the way to see that is actually also very simple. So these are the Gaussian terms. So let's think about the non-Gaussian terms, right? What are the non-Gaussian terms from this? The way to think about this is to go to Bufnev's talk and basically think about four-point function. This is basically a four-point function, but a very specific kind of four-point function where two of the pairs actually are degenerate. They are actually at the same point. So if you look at the four-point function, let me call that the four-point function at 1, 2, 3, and 4. If you recall, basically, gravitational instability, it gives you this hierarchy of correlation that relates endpoint function to two-point functions. And if you look at this, the four-point function, there are actually several terms, but one of the terms people call snake diagrams, and basically it goes like this. That's one term that goes like the two-point function between 1 and 2, the two-point function between 2 and 3, and the two-point function between 3 and 4. In other words, the endpoint function goes like the two-point function to the n minus 1 power. That's the usual hierarchy that people talk about. And if you look at this term and you apply it to this case, you can clearly see there is a term that goes like linear in psi. So in particular, if you actually apply this to here, if you contract this and this, if you look at the non-Gaussian term, contract this and this, you get a psi 1 square. If you contract this and this, you get a psi 1 square, phi 1, phi 2, and then you get phi 2 square. So this term is actually directly proportional to psi, so it's linear in the two-point correlation function, which actually means that on large scales, the non-Gaussian contribution actually dominates over the Gaussian contribution, which is kind of counterintuitive. And the reason why this happens is actually very simple. It's because of this very particular combination where the observable at each point depends on the field at the same point to some nonlinear power squared. And that's basically why you have this kind of effect, and it dominates. And I just want to show you a transparency why this is relevant. So let me show you this transparency, which is taken from a paper by Rob Crittenden and Whaley and collaborators, where this is measurements of the lensing ellipticity correlation, the shear two-point correlation function as a function of angular scale. It looks like this. This is based on their analytic calculation, what is the intrinsic alignment contribution. And as you see, it falls faster. This one falls faster than this one because the lensing correlation basically more or less goes like psi to the first power, and whereas on large scale, this goes like psi squared, that's why. But if what I said is correct, actually it's not true that this drops faster. In fact, it doesn't drop faster. Of course, in this case, the contribution is small because these galaxies have a high redshift. If you go to shallower survey, this is usually a more important contribution, the intrinsic alignment. I'll just end with this one, which is a graph I took from Heavens et al., which actually show their measurement of this effect of the intrinsic alignment from simulations, where you can kind of see that it doesn't actually drop like psi squared. So what they show, roughly this is the two-point function, but this is actually in L space, and this is theta. And this is basically linear in psi, and this is what they measured from their simulation of the intrinsic alignment. You can see it doesn't actually drop significantly faster than linear in psi. So now, of course, I think from a pure, just simple analytic guess, the amplitude of this fluctuation I think is highly uncertain. I think they are measuring L. I think they are actually. My impression is they did exactly what you were trying to capture, where they actually.
I don't know which process came from, but they.
I see. There are two versions.
Yeah, there are two versions of that. I'm not sure which one.
I see. Yeah, my impression is this is they were trying to measure exactly basically the same thing.
As where?
Yes, that's my impression. But I should say, the exact amplitude is highly uncertain. I mean, one thing is, if you have nonlinear processes going on, there might be, random kicks to the dark orientation of galaxies. That would basically, it could actually lower the overall amplitude of the intrinsic alignment without changing the shape. So that's all I have to say.